Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, this is pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hey, it's the evening edition. I'm Tasha Fusil, and it's Happily Ever After, the show that takes a closer look at the fairy tales that we fell in love with once upon a time. Now, some of you may know this. The Disney fairy tales that we grew up with are, in reality, these really, really watered-down versions of fairy tales that have been around for centuries. And those original stories, they were really dark. For example, in the original Sleeping Beauty, the princess doesn't wake up after 100 years of sleep by a true love's kiss. Quite the opposite, really. A king comes along, sees that she's sleeping, likes the look of her, and then rapes her in her sleep. And she ends up giving birth to two children. No consent given, nothing. Which sounds really a lot more like a scene from Kill Bill than a Disney cartoon. And you'll find that same sort of sex and violence in almost every original fairy tale that we would know of today. So this evening, we're going to be looking at this curious evolution with Maria Tatar.
My name's Maria Tatar, and I teach at Harvard University in the program in folklore and mythology.
So fairy tales began as stories that were shared orally. You wouldn't find them in books, but eventually a few people did start to collect and print them. And maybe it's because of their name, but one of the most well-known collectors were, of course, the Grimm brothers. In the early 1800s, Jakob and Wilhelm Grimm were the guys who first gathered stories like Sleeping Beauty, Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood, and Cinderella.
The brothers Grimm were as close as you can get, I think, as siblings. And it's no surprise that they recorded stories like Hansel and Gretel, a fairy tale that is about a brother and sister, but two siblings who have to face up to a monster, defeat it, and return home to live happily ever after. So they grew up in the small town of Hanau, and the great crisis in their lives was the death of their father when they were, I think Jakob was 10 and Wilhelm was 11. And suddenly they were plunged into poverty from a sort of middle class existence to barely surviving. I think it's Jack Zipes who called their life something like a fairy tale, because they managed to go from rags to not quite riches, but certainly erudition. They go to university, they study law, and then they spend the rest of their lives in pretty much in their study, working together on all kinds of projects, not just the collection of fairy tales, but also the German dictionary and all kinds of editions of sagas and legends and myths. They were as prolific as you could get.
And were they sort of known at the time for the work that they were doing, or were they sort of just, you know, they started out? How did they go from practicing law to getting involved in these kinds of projects? Was that a norm at the time?
Well, for one thing, they got fired. So they were part of a protest movement. They were university professors, and they were part of a protest movement in the town of Göttingen. And they were fired from their posts in 1837 and became sort of independent scholars for a while, applying for jobs. And they finally settled in Berlin. And they had already established themselves as important scholars at the time. So the path was not that easy. But once they were in Berlin, they could really devote themselves to legal practice, as Jakob did. And Wilhelm, I think, was the one who spent more time on the fairy tales, on editing the successive editions of the fairy tales.
Were they, you know, in terms of their personal life, were they married? Did they have kids?
Jakob remained a bachelor, and Wilhelm married and had children. And I think that explains to some extent his greater interest in the fairy tales. Wilhelm was caught up, or Jakob rather, was caught up in the legal profession, in diplomatic matters, and Wilhelm, with this very robust domestic life, found that, you know, storytelling was something really key to family life, and nurtured that interest over the years.
When did they start to collect the stories, and what was the idea behind that initially?
The Grimm started collecting early on, that is about 1807 or so. I mean, imagine, they were only in their 20s, and they decided that they would take on this massive project of collecting folklore, German folklore, in part because the stories that they had heard as children seemed to be disappearing and fading away, in part because of urbanization and then, of course, you know, what is looming ahead but the Industrial Revolution. So it was very shrewd of them to realize that the times were changing and that the sites for oral storytelling were gradually beginning to disappear. So they wanted to preserve, but then they had another mission, which was to collect documents that would preserve German traditions. They wanted to sort of consolidate national identity through this cultural heritage. So these were, above all, German tales that would be told, and this mission developed over the years, that would be told to children to remind them of who they were, and also to, and this is the ironic part of it, to sort of model good behavior, because there's a lot of bad behavior in fairy tales, too.
These stories, as you said, were extremely violent, but were they being told as sort of sources of entertainment? You know, as you said, there wasn't much by way of entertainment. Were these sort of their version of Game of Thrones, their version of Breaking Bad?
Well, I think you're onto something there. That is, if you imagine these long winter evenings, or long summer evenings for that matter, there's nothing to do, and how do you, when you tell a story, you have to keep the attention of your listeners who are carrying out these boring household tasks, repetitive chores, repairing tools, spinning, sewing, cooking, and all of that. You want to keep everybody awake, and how do you do it the way that we do it today, which is, you know, to pack the story with melodrama, which means there's going to be sex and violence, indeed. And in some ways, of course, that accounts for the staying power of these stories, because they are so overwrought, so exaggerated. They are larger than life and twice as unnatural, I would say, almost. And as a result, they're memorable. They're easy to repeat. You know, one of the reasons I think that we have kept these stories is that they're so easy to recapitulate. You get the bare bones. When I say Little Red Riding Hood, I think the story flashes into your mind. And when you retell it, you may change the details, but the basic structure of the story will stay the same.
So with reference to the violence that was sort of so prevalent in all the stories, I think when we hear about it now in this century, it sort of draws to mind the assumption that the 1800s was a less civilized society. So that is a wrong assumption then. There wasn't that much violence happening, just occurring in the daily lives of people for them to accept this kind of violence, was there?
I think that there's always violence. If you go back to the time that the Grimms were young, there were all kinds of scenes of violence. There was hardship. Life was nasty. The Grimms at one time referred to the fact that they only had enough food for one meal a day. Now, it's not violence, but, you know, it's certainly hardship, and it reflects the fact that there were a lot of people starving in those days, and there was political and social unrest. I wish, you know, we could say, oh, that was an era when things were just fine. It was utopian. Of course, you know, there are these sort of pastoral, idyllic moments in certain times and places, but I would say, on the whole, violence has been a feature of life since the caveman, basically. So certainly times were different, but I think the kind of exposure to violence, to disease, to poverty, to family dysfunctionality were not all that different.
Having said that, there were certain creepy and weird themes, you know, things about incest and cannibalism that were quite commonplace in fairy tales. So Maria will tell us more about that when we come back. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
And now, an ad from Dad.
All right, save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive.
Can I take these off?
All right. What is this? This looks good.
Wow. That's well made.
Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
It's the Evening Edition with me, Tasha Fusil, along with my guest, Maria Tatar, who teaches folklore and mythology at Harvard University. We've been talking about the brutality that you'd find in the original fairy tales from way back when. These stories were, of course, being told during a time when there wasn't much at all by way of entertainment. And maybe this inspired people to come up with these crazy stories that would shock and appall. Tales that today would either be banished or relegated to some seriously messed up and dark, dark corners of the web.
It's astonishing, isn't it, when you look at some of the stories that are no longer in the collection. For example, one about a starving mother who threatens to eat her daughters because of a famine. I mean, that's unimaginable. And, there may be some sort of case, some sort of singular pathology that is reflected in that story. There may have been some sort of terrible news story like that, but it was an anomaly rather than something that happened frequently, certainly.
Yeah, and I mean, we get these sort of, unfortunately, you know, in the news today, we hear all kinds of horror stories about terrible things that are being done, and they often sometimes, you know, become an influence for some of the films that we see today.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, family dysfunctionality. We know that, unfortunately, that's also a timeless universal. It happens in every culture. We like to think that, you know, incest is not something that happens today, but it obviously does, and it's kept quiet, and it's repressed. And in the fairy tale, it's right there, and it's writ large. So on the one hand, there's a story like Cinderella, in which you have an abusive stepmother, and a tale that we feel comfortable with, and we keep re-scripting and retelling and recycling in the Hollywood dream factory. But then there's another story, which is in the Grimm's collection, called Allerleihau. It can be translated as Thousand Furs, in which we find that the mother of a young girl dies, and what does her father do but propose to her? And he tells her that he has to marry her because he promised his wife that he would only marry someone who was as beautiful as she was. So the daughter has to flee the household, hide in the woods, and then she reemerges and works as a scullery maid at the castle of a king, and then works her way back to royalty, to being part of a royal family. But it's quite a story, and it's always puzzled me that we have disavowed that story and yet embraced the tale about the evil stepmother who actually thinks that she will be able to murder her stepdaughter.
Is it in any way a reflection of also of who is doing the editing. I mean, the story about, A Thousand Foot, like, I read about that and I can't wrap my head around it. And to me, the villain in that story is the king, right? It's monstrous what he wants to do. It's unfathomable. But he's the king. And on the other hand, there's Cinderella and there's Snow White, when the villains are the women. And I can't help but wonder at least whether that has something to do with who is editing these stories.
Oh, yes, for sure. And think of the contrast, too, in those stories. In something like Snow White, the stepmother dances to death in red-hot iron shoes. And then in Alla Leihau, in Thousand Furs, what happens at the end? The king is exonerated. It's said that he was just seized by a mad passion, and everybody lives happily ever after. So it seems clear to me that had the editor of the children's stories and household tales of the Grimm's collection included a woman, the stories might have turned out rather differently. Even the selection of the stories would have been different, I think.
Right. And how did they go about sort of, what was there a selection criteria? Were they going to sources to collect these stories? And how did they verify sort of which versions were the ones that they wanted to commit to paper?
It's so interesting how the Grimms went about this process. That is, first they wrote to all their friends and colleagues soliciting stories and telling them that they wanted to create this scholarly record. Now, they referred again and again to the oral storytelling tradition among peasants, and yet, as many scholars have shown, the sources were basically middle class, sometimes friends in their own social circle, sometimes the tradesmen, tradespeople in the region. And many of their sources also were of French ancestry. So you could see that these weren't quite German tales, but certainly European tales. So they collected these stories, wrote them down for the first edition, added this tremendous scholarly commentary, which reveals to us that they often, say in the case of Snow White, they had several sources. They had at least a half a dozen sources. And from that, they constructed a kind of ideal type, as it were. And then over the years, they shifted so many things so that in Snow White, what happens? The biological mother turns into the murderous stepmother. And in the later versions of Snow White, the biological mother dies in childbirth. And it's the stepmother who sends the hunter into the woods to kill Snow White. Also, in the early version of Snow White, it's the father who rescues the daughter in the end, and who manages to bring the coffin home, and he obviously doesn't, well, not so obviously. I think he awakens her when the coffin is moved or something like that. There's no kiss involved as in the Disney version or something like that. But you can see how they kept changing the stories in ways that corresponded to their own ethos. They wanted to keep the purity of the biological mother. They didn't mind a demonic evil stepmother, on the other hand. And so the edition went through, well, let's see, the first edition came out 1812, 1815, and then the seventh edition wasn't published until, I think, 1857.
So when they first collected it, they were looking just to preserve cultural tradition. But when did it sort of, was it something that was published at a mass scale that they were able to, you know, take a litmus test to see how popular these stories were, what sort of reception people were having to it? And is that why they kept refining these stories and coming up with more and more editions?
Oh, it's an interesting question. When was the exact inflection point when Wilhelm Grimm and Jakob, to some extent, also decided that this was not just going to be a set of stories to collect a cultural heritage, but something that would be designed to serve as a manual of manners. And I think the shift came in the 30s and 40s, and it was after the reviews of the fairy tales. Many of the critics looked at that first edition and thought, look at these vulgar, crude tales. Why are they being put on paper? Why are they being printed? And there was a sense of shame about these stories. There was nothing pure about them. And why were they so raunchy and racy? And who would ever want to read these stories to a child? The title was, after all, Kinder und Hausmärchen, Children's Stories and Household Tales, sort of reflecting a double audience. But over time, it was the children who became important, and the edition became more child-friendly. I think it was in 1848 that the Grimms decided that they would publish an abbreviated edition, a kleine Ausgabe, a compact edition that contained a small set of stories that it was a brilliant marketing move, by the way, because it sold very well. It was small. It was less expensive than the larger edition.
When did they start sort of monetizing? Was it at that point when they published the abbreviated version?
Monetizing came a little bit earlier than that, but it reached its height, really, with the compact edition. And as I said, you know, in some ways they're responding to the reviewers who don't like the vulgarity of the collection, but then they're beginning to see, oh, we've got an audience and we've got buyers. That is, parents are going to be buying this book for children. And that is, in fact, what happened over time. Not quite overnight, but, you know, it was this wonderful process that took place over a period of several decades. And it reveals that the Grimms were being somewhat opportunistic, but they also managed to create a kind of literary fairy tale that really worked. You know, if you decide you're going to write these stories down, you have to do a lot of work. You can't just transcribe what somebody is saying, because usually the story from the oral storytelling tradition falls flat on the written page. You have to make some changes, and the Grimms brilliantly knew how to do that.
So as Maria says, there were many changes and edits made over the years. Sex, for the most part, was removed, but they upped the ante on the violence. We'll find out more about that after the 7:30 news. Don't go anywhere. It's the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
Hello again, it's Happily Ever After here on the Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fusil, and I've been speaking to Maria Tatar, a professor of folklore and mythology at Harvard University. She's written tons of books on fairy tales and folklore, and today she's talking to us about the Grimm brothers and their collection of fairy tales. Now, the Grimm brothers published several iterations of their stories. A lot of the original stories had strong sexual elements to them, but as they became more popular, they were either reduced or removed altogether to make the stories a little bit more appropriate for their growing young audience. But while the Grimm brothers thought it was a good idea to edit out the sexual elements from these stories, they actually increased the quotient on violence and brutality. Here's Maria to help explain the reasoning behind that.
I think it was important for them to take out stories like Hans Dumm, the one in which a fellow looks at a woman and makes her pregnant. It was too much. It was a story really for adults. Or take the story of Rapunzel up in the tower. The prince is visiting her on a daily basis, and one day Rapunzel says to the enchantress, as she's called, "Why are my clothes getting so tight?" That is, she doesn't make the connection between the prince's visits and, you know, the fact that she is pregnant, she's with child. So the Grimms took that out and just had Rapunzel give birth magically. There is no direct connection drawn to the visits of the prince. So gradually these allusions to pregnancy, to any sort of sexual encounters were taken out. And then at the same time, the Grimms didn't seem to feel as concerned. They weren't troubled by the violence in the tales, but the fact that a curious girl in Frau Trude, Dame Trudy, is turned into a piece of firewood by a witch and then thrown on the fire. She's turned into a log and she burns up, and that's the end of the story. So somehow these punishments seemed appropriate. That is, there was a lesson in that story. Don't be curious. Don't enter the house of the witch and start looking around. So that was, again, kind of the disciplinary regime that the Grimms embraced in some ways in successive editions of the tales.
Right. There's a particular story called The Robber Bridegroom, where bandits drag a maiden into a hideout and then they force her to drink wine until her heart bursts, and then they rip off her clothes and hack her body into pieces. So is the purpose of having all this violence purely just to serve as caution to children? Don't do something that might land you in trouble.
Well, I think it fits in with the tradition of cautionary tales in the 19th century. That is, anywhere you look, there are these stories about terrible things that happen to children when they get too close to fire or something like that. And the story of Little Red Riding Hood is a classic example of that. There was a time when Little Red Riding Hood was a trickster and outwitted the wolf. But in the 19th century, what happens? That turns into the story about the dangers of straying from the path. That is, you've got to pay attention, stay on the road, not be adventurous, not explore, not be intrigued by the flowers, which is, you know, Little Red Riding Hood moves from the path because she's picking beautiful flowers. She's seduced by beauty. And what happens? She runs into trouble with the wolf. So suddenly, you know, we've got these stories that are designed to scare children into good behavior. Deeply ironic, because, of course, we know children are contrarians. And they like to do just the opposite. When they read a story about being in the woods, they don't necessarily want to meet the monster, but they do like the adventure in there. And also, you know, it's odd because today, of course, we have all these stories about cultivating curiosity. Curiosity is something we value. It's so complex and fascinating to sort of see what did the 19th century see as their agenda for children's literature. And in many cases, it was promoting obedience, discouraging curiosity, telling you that when you transgress, you're really going to get hurt. And as I say, that agenda often backfires. Yeah.
Was there, was there ever any intention to teach children about other things, for example, like politics or religion? Were those things that had any influence, especially with how the Grimm brothers themselves felt about whatever was happening around them politically and culturally?
Yes, well, you know, fairy tales, we often think of them as being totally benign, even with the violence in them, but as confections, sort of meaningless. And I would say to that no story is really culturally innocent. There's always some kind of ideology embedded in the story, political, social, cultural. It's not easy to sort out the different discourses in a story. There are, though, obvious moments that we can look at in the collection, obvious passages or stories. The Jew in the Thorn Bush, that's a story that we certainly would not want to read to children today, but one that is of great historical interest and one that we should read to sort of understand the Grimm's age, the era, and the fact that it was perfectly all right to tell a story in which a Jew is punished for the sins of the hero, and punished in a terrible way, beaten and tortured, thrown into a thorn bush, really for no reason except that he has lent money to the hero of the tale. So the fact that this was acceptable and that it was included in the compact edition for children. So there's a lot of baggage in these tales and things that, you know, we should analyze and look at. And that's sort of a flagrant example of anti-Semitism embedded in the tales. But there are also many more subtle moments in the tales that, you know, reflect ideological orientations.
Yeah, there were some comments made about how some of these stories were used as propaganda.
Well, I think that certainly Nazi ideologues embraced these stories, in part because the Grimms wrote a preface in which they praised the purity of the folk spirit, and they sort of saw these tales as expressing the soul of Germanic peoples and that kind of thing. So there was a kind of blood and soil aspect to these stories. They were authentic, they were German, and there was a sense of national pride in the poetry created by the people. The Grimm's sort of fetishizing of the folk, the people as, you know, these agricultural workers, an agrarian culture that was somehow... that whole ideology was appropriated by the Nazis.
Well, you know, when you first came across these stories, the original versions, what was your reaction when you first read them? I mean, did the violence shock you? Were you surprised that this was sort of coming out from this era, this time period?
I remember I was reading the stories to my children, and then I decided I would do a little research on the Grimms, and then came across some of the earlier versions. And I was shocked by them, but I was also shocked by the stories that circulate today, not just in Germany, but in the U.S. You know, the fact that Snow White's the stepmother dances to death in red-hot iron shoes. I think the fact that when Cinderella leaves the church, doves come and peck out the eyes of her stepsisters. So remember, that was the big shocker. And then the juniper tree. I made the terrible mistake of starting to read the juniper tree and realizing, you know, there's this woman who chops up her stepson into little pieces and feeds him to his father in a stew. What is that doing in a collection of tales for children? And, of course, that's when you begin to see that, you know, these stories weren't really intended for children. Children sometimes heard them and listened to them and took them in, but they are mythical, and they're not sacred stories, but they're sort of domestic versions of the myths.
You know, we're so intrigued today. You know, I think if you do a quick Google search, you can find all kinds of articles, you know, the top 10 most gruesome fairy tales from the Grimm brothers. So there is definitely this fascination with the violence. Is there a reason for that? I mean, and when you think about sort of like some of the things that we're seeing today on TV, are we that far off? Are we that different, really, in the kinds of violence that we're exposed to or we're exposing our children to today?
That's a tough question because it has many different elements to it. One of the things that I guess a mantra of mine is that the human mind thinks everywhere alike, and that there's something about the way that we're wired that makes it difficult not to repeat things. Somehow, you know, violence is a fact of life, conflict. We will never find utopia. We will never create utopia. And then, of course, you know, the question is, do we want utopia? Conflict and violence seem to be part of the human condition, for better or for worse. And sometimes conflict leads to productive change and to good things. But as we, you know, we read the headlines and we know conflict also leads to terrible things. So one of the important things about fairy tales, I think, is that they are a reminder of the constants in human nature. And yet, at the same time, it's the fairy tale which really focuses on the question of metamorphosis and transformation and change and the possibility of change. Beauty and the Beast. The Beast can become human and become lovable, and when you show compassion and love, you can change the world. So oddly, there's that mix of the fairy tale on the one hand sending the message. Our brains are wired in a certain way, and yet there's a certain utopian aspect as well, suggesting that things can become better and that we can sort of evolve in positive directions rather than negative ones.
Right. And we're seeing that today with the fairy tales, right? The stories are evolving as we speak. The Cinderella that we grew up watching and reading about is different from today's Cinderella, and it's going to be different probably 5 generations from now. Like, our great-great-grandkids are going to hear the versions that we've grown up with and think that they're weird.
Oh, yes, and you think of all these warrior women that are emerging. I'd like to call them tricksters. That is, women who are empowered, who have an arsenal of weapons, and not necessarily, you know, bows and arrows and things like that, but who actually use strategy and are smart and courageous and are able to turn things around. I worry sometimes that it's a little bit too much about revenge and getting back, but that is a dramatic change. And, you know, I haven't seen the new Wonder Woman yet, but evidently she's something of a fairy tale trickster who is able to turn the tables on the villains in all kinds of clever ways, not just through her physical strength and her magical powers, but through the use of her quick intelligence.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, I think. There are these icons of empowerment emerging, and in some ways, they're so different. But in other ways, you know, you still can't run away from these connections that we have to beauty. I'm curious about how a figure like her emerges today and what that's going to evolve and look like a few generations from now.
Oh, yes, and we still, you're absolutely right, because it's still the superhero, the glamorous, beautiful girl. Frozen, for example. I'm always astonished by the fact that both sisters look like Barbie dolls. But somehow we can't get away from that stereotype. And gosh, do you think that Hollywood will ever produce? Let's look at Shrek. There, Fiona chooses to become the green monster. The transformation is into a creature who is physically grotesque, and that's embraced as an ideal. So, you know, to me, it's so fascinating that, you know, we do make it new, and yet there's always the question of, yes, it's not the same old story, but is it really all that different, and are we caught in this sort of trap of simply shifting the kaleidoscope a little bit, turning it so that things look different, but the components, the basic elements are still the same.
So fairy tales have come a long way. The violence and sexuality that was accepted then really has no place in the realm of children's literature today. But for better or worse, there are things about the fairy tale genre that it seems will never really change. Do you think that's okay, or do you find it problematic? We would love to know. You can tweet us at BFM Radio or drop us a message at 018-789-8899. I'm Tasha Fusil, and it's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the... Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.